Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Lake Okeechobee is filled with the green slime that is stinking up the area and making life miserable for people and animals dependent on it. It's the algae blooms, and that algae is spreading to both the east and west coast of Florida and hurting home values, tourism, and local businesses. Last week, Governor Rick Scott ordered a state of emergency. The Army Corps of Engineers has to release water from the lake from time to time because the Herbert Hoover Dyke is old and in desperate need of repair. How do we deal with the algal problem in a political fight that's been going on for decades? We're joined now by ecologist Steve Davis with the Everglades Foundation. Steve, thanks so much for being here today, man.
Thanks for having me.
So how would you describe the current state of Lake Okeechobee and this entire algae bloom issue, which, by the way, is not new? We went through this a couple of years ago. It was really bad.
Well, the situation today in Lake Okeechobee is that we have about 80% of the lake covered in blue-green algae. We just got the latest satellite imagery that was interpreted from NOAA, and they've shown that we had a gap of several days with cloudy features in the imagery, so we couldn't get the information. But the July 14th image showed that the lake is covered with about 80% of algae, and that's been the case for the last couple of weeks.
And there's something unique about this time around than what we saw, for example, like in 2016. What is it? What's going on now?
Well, what we have is a blue-green algae species, Microcystis aeruginosa, that really thrives in high nutrient conditions. And by nutrients, I mean nitrogen and phosphorus. And in South Florida, phosphorus is really the most problematic. It's derived largely from fertilizers. And it has accumulated to the point in Lake Okeechobee that this particular species thrives. And it seems to be thriving in warmer temperatures. So as we get into the hottest summer months, the longest days of the year, it seems to be out-competing all other species.
And you talk about that phosphorus, you're talking about fertilizer, so can we put a finger on who the culprit is?
No, it's really accumulation over several decades, contributions from north of Lake Okeechobee, as well as a few decades of contributions from south of Lake Okeechobee in the Everglades agricultural area. And it's led to a layer several inches thick of muck in the bottom of the lake that is very rich in phosphorus. And we're also today still seeing high levels of phosphorus and nitrogen coming into Lake Okeechobee from the contributing basins to the north, like Kissimmee River.
So all of that is basically, for decades, as you said, it's just been piling up, sitting there at the bottom of the lake. Eventually it gets stirred up. Is that what it is? It gets stirred up, it grows eventually, and then it starts, it turns the water this really disgusting green that we've seen so many photos of now.
Yes, and you mentioned stirring up, and we think that Hurricane Irma had a significant impact last year in September as the storm passed over the central part of the state and really whipped up the lake. It's a shallow lake. Many people don't realize that, you know, it's only 9-10 feet deep at its deepest. So that is with such a large surface area subject to mixing all the way down to the bottom with a storm like Hurricane Irma.
And so what happens is, as we've mentioned, the Army Corps of Engineers plays a big role in this because when that water level gets to a certain point, now there's a danger to the dike that is protecting all those communities around the lake. So they have to release water, and they release it east and west on the Caloosahatchee and the St. Lucie. And, of course, that ends up in the estuaries, which ends up, we see, on the coasts. The Army Corps of Engineers, I mean, how did they decide how many times they have to release? And really, I mean, is it just up to them, or can the state say, wait a minute, you're releasing this stuff, and we're seeing this slime just head in both directions, and that's hurting a lot of people. But who's making that final decision? Is it the Army Corps of Engineers?
Well, the Army Corps of Engineers abides by an operating document. It's the Lake Okeechobee Regulation Schedule that was actually revised following Hurricane Katrina when they were asked to go back and reevaluate dam safety standards. So the lake schedule that we're currently operating under was passed in 2008. That schedule takes into consideration the fact that we have a very fragile dike that is in need of repair. and efforts are being made to complete those repairs, especially for the more vulnerable areas. But you're right, as lake levels rise, they have no other choice but to release to the east and the west. That's the way the infrastructure was set up over a half century ago, when there was a need to provide flood protection for those communities that were developing to the south of the lake. So the system is working exactly the way it was designed. Everglades restoration, the comprehensive Everglades restoration plan, was actually devised as a way to work within the confines of providing flood protection and water supply for these communities, but also recognizing that there's a need for the environment. Reducing those discharges to the east and the west will have a great effect in allowing those areas to recover and improve, but also it provides that water to the Everglades all the way down to Everglades National Park and Florida Bay to the south.
I want to come back and remind people of what these algal blooms actually are and what they, the harm they cause. You know, besides just looking really disgusting, and I've been told, I haven't experienced it myself, the smell is intense, but what's the danger, the risk to the wildlife? And because, you know, think about Lake Okeechobee, so much of that is about fishing and the tourists there, but also to humans. What's the risk?
Well, I'll touch on the concerns with regard to the environment first, and we know quite a lot about. First, we know that when algal blooms occur, they occur in such abundance that they affect light penetration into the water that other organisms need. And when you get into estuaries, you think of seagrasses, the important habitat that they provide to coastal fisheries. When you have algal blooms in places like the Caloosahatchee Estuary near Fort Myers, that blocks out the light for seagrass. So seagrass dies. Habitat is affected. These algal blooms also not only produce oxygen like a plant does during the day, but they're also consuming oxygen over the nighttime. And when you have very hot water and intense algal blooms, we run into situations of hypoxic conditions over the nighttime hours. And so you'll have some species of fish succumbing to the very low levels of oxygen in the water that they need in order to survive. But then we also add in this other layer that these organisms can produce toxins when they're growing in certain numbers and densities. And so it's the toxins that also become a compounding factor that also result in human health concerns.
So, I mean, I hear that and I'm thinking to myself, well, okay, this is Florida and you talk about these temperatures, the hot temperatures, and we're in that time of year, so we're just, what, supposed to expect this is going to go through and last the rest of the summer? We're just going to have to deal with it?
I think that many people feel that we may continue to see these blooms through the summer. What it typically takes in order for these blooms to subside, one is a flushing event. So a large storm that might deliver a lot of water into Lake Okeechobee, where if possible, we try to minimize the discharges to the east and the west, send as much as we can to the south. But that water needs to be turned over because it's the biomass of algae that's accumulated in the lake that's causing the bloom. The other thing would be cooling temperatures as we move into the fall and winter that might.
So that's this summer. But then, you know, that means we're talking about every summer. And as with climate change, the temperatures just keep going up. So what? This is just going to get worse?
We don't know. We can expect to see blooms like this in the future, especially with warmer temperatures. We're learning that this particular species of blue-green algae thrives in high temperatures. So as water temperatures get up to 95 degrees, you might find that other algae reduce their uptake of nutrients and reduce their growth. This particular species seems to continue to thrive under those higher temperatures. So we need to resolve the nutrient problem, but we've also got to find another outlet for that water, and that's where Everglades restoration comes in.
All right, let's talk about that here. Again, we're discussing the impact of Florida's massive algae bloom spreading from Lake Okeechobee and causing problems throughout the state. Joining me in studio is Stephen Davis. He's the ecologist with the Everglades Foundation. Okay, so we talk about solutions. Part of it is not putting so much of this phosphorus into the system. But that's only one part of it. I'd read that if we tried to go in and scrape it out, it would take decades. So what is the other solution is to try to get the water to flow south as it did naturally. What are we doing about that right now?
Well, we actually have good news to report for those of you who aren't aware that we have a plan for a reservoir. This is a really the centerpiece of the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, a reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee in the agricultural area that will allow us to take water from the lake and send it south. So instead of discharging the water to the east and the west, you fill that reservoir to the south. Recognizing that that water is polluted with nutrients, as we've talked about, before water flows into the Everglades, there's a federal consent decree that water quality standards, particularly for phosphorus, need to be met before that water can flow south into the Everglades. So there's a network of treatment marsh area, roughly 60,000 acres right now, that are currently being used to treat water that runs off those lands into the Everglades. So we would have a storage and treatment system that would allow us to flow substantial quantities of water each year from Lake Okeechobee to the south. And to put it into perspective, we're talking about 370,000 acre feet per year on average. And that number may not make much sense to people, but it's roughly the area, if you think of a column of water, the area of a football field, 70 miles high, that is the volume of water that we're going to be able to send south each year.
Do we have an area-specific location where that reservoir would be located?
The area has been identified. It's state-owned land that's currently being leased to sugar farmers. That land will be used for the reservoir as well as an additional treatment component. So it's going to be roughly a 10,000-acre footprint for the reservoir and then an additional 6,500 acres for the additional treatment capacity needed to make sure that that water's clean.
So where are we in the process of building that?
We have a report that was just passed through the executive branch and is now being considered by the Senate for their water resources development legislation. The House has passed their version. The Senate will now deliberate on theirs, and we hope that by the end of this year, we'll have a Water Resources Development Act that we can say this project is included in and will be advanced in the near future.
And that's depending on the U.S. government. But, you know, we've had this fight in Tallahassee for years and years about how to deal with this issue. I mean, just your opinion, your thoughts on how how legislators in Tallahassee have dealt with it. I mean, do you feel they've done enough?
Well, I can't speak to the entire legislature, but I can point to a champion that we had going back to 2016 when this occurred in Lake Okeechobee and we had the discharges that led to toxic algae in the St. Lucie. Then Senate President Joe Negron, whose constituency was most affected by the toxic algae in the Stewart area, he took this on as his mission as Senate President and really pushed to get through the legislature the enactments to get this reservoir planned by the state, which they did in very short order. And the timeline was expedited, but it's included as part of a post-authorization change to a project that was already authorized by Congress called the Central Everglades Plan. So this project is being advanced as part of that effort.
You know, there was also, because one of the things people were trying to figure out is to remove what's already there. I mean, we could wait for a reservoir. Obviously, the dike needs work as well, but you know about this, the George Barley Water Prize. So this is a prize up to $10 million. They're trying to find any group that can come in and figure out how can we remove a lot of this algae. And I believe they're down to a few finalists. They're expected to name the winners in August. Is that a possible solution? Do we need to, you know, head to the private sector or some other kind of competition where we find other people who come along and say, maybe we find a solution? I don't know. What do you think about that?
I think it's going to be a combination of solutions and management strategies to solve our nutrient pollution problem. It's not just an Everglades problem. It's a global problem. I mean, you think about the Mississippi River and the Louisiana, the dead zone offshore. All of that is attributable to a legacy of nutrient pollution. And management can only do so much because we have this problem of polluted water bodies like Lake Okeechobee, and you described how seemingly impossible it would be to clean that water body up. So our board tasked us with managing a prize, kind of like an X Prize. It's called the George Barley Water Prize, that would spur innovation of technologies that might be in their infancy and usher along the cream of the crop, really, that are very effective at removing phosphorus pollution and could be scalable to large water bodies.
Have you seen any of the ideas? Anything jumps out at you like that may be a really good one?
I have not been evaluating the technologies, especially those that recently competed as part of the recent stage in Toronto in a polluted water body up near in Canada. But I think that we know what technologies are out there. It's really combinations of different technologies and determining their effectiveness. And part of that is their cost. We currently use, as I mentioned earlier, 60,000 acres of land to clean out the pollution from the water flowing into the Everglades. That's obviously a very land-intensive and very costly technology. If we can lower the cost, even an incremental amount, you think of scaling up, that would result in significant savings, not just for South Florida, but globally.
Let me finish with this. I know that our neighbors to the west over in Naples and Fort Myers and that area, they are hit really hard because obviously being in the Gulf of Mexico, the algae has a chance to sit a lot longer and it covers a bigger area. And then on the East Coast, you tend to see it up in the Stewart area, which is the North Palm Beach County area as well. But down here in Broward, you know, Miami-Dade counties, we're not seeing it as much. We're not seeing that slime, that we're not dealing with it. How does it impact us, and why should people down here care?
Well, I think people should care first and foremost because we have a pollution problem somewhere within the region. I think we're finding that we're all affected by it because once it gets into the national and international press, toxic algae in Florida, being such a tourist-based economy, I think clearly we're being impacted by that. The Everglades is South Florida's water supply. The Biscayne Aquifer that many of us along the Lower East Coast depend upon for our water supply is recharged by the Everglades. We're currently dumping, as of today, about 4 billion gallons of water per day to the Coosahatchee and the St. Lucie. That's water that could be flowing south to the Everglades, providing for the needs of habitats and coastal water bodies like Florida Bay, Biscayne Bay, that many people recreate in. But it also serves to recharging our water supply.
This is one of those stories that isn't going away anytime soon. It's been a battle for many years, and it seems to be getting worse. What's the solution? Well, there are a lot of different ideas out there. Again, talking with Stephen Davis, ecologist with the Everglades Foundation, he gave us a couple of those ideas. But we definitely would love to hear from you if you happen to live or if you've seen any of this, these algae blooms. Share that with us. Find us on Twitter or on Facebook, WLRN Sundial. Again, I don't know if I want to get out there, and I've heard what it smells like. Don't know if I want to experience that. Mr. Davis, thanks so much. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you, Lewis.
We'll get you back in here. We'll find out if Congress does move forward, as you mentioned, with the idea for that reservoir. Still to come on the program, what happens when a country seizes your website? We have the story of a South Florida man who's in a battle with the country of France. It's all coming up next on the program here on WLRN.